Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
Erdogan, bütün iftira ve...
Despite all his smear campaigns and insults, Erdogan did not get the result he expected. Nobody should get excited, but a fait accompli.
Turkey appears to be headed for a presidential runoff that could put an end to Tayyip Erdogan's 20 years in power. We'll go to Istanbul for the latest. Then a ceasefire has been reached in Gaza after Israel killed 33 Palestinians over 5 days.
The ceasefire is good for us. We can return to life, fishing, working, and breathing again. We can move in and out and try to make a living from fishing and to move around without being harassed.
The ceasefire in Gaza comes as Palestinians mark the 75th anniversary of what they call the Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe, when over 700,000 Palestinians fled or were violently expelled from their homes in 1948 when Israel was founded. We'll speak to two Palestinians who've traveled to New York as the United Nations today officially commemorates the Nakba for the first time. We'll also speak with Peter Beiner of Jewish Currents.
There are powerful forces in this Israeli government that would like to try to bring about another mass expulsion. A whole series of ministers in this Israeli government have talked favorably about the idea of an effort to remove large numbers of Palestinians from the West Bank or even from Israel proper.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Turkey, the closely watched election that will determine whether President Recep Tayyip Erdogan will remain in power appears headed to a May 28th runoff, as Erdogan fell just short of the 50% of votes needed to win outright. Erdogan's two-decade-long grip on power was challenged by the leading opposition candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who vowed closer ties with NATO and the European Union and to reinforce democratic institutions. A third candidate, a right-wing challenger, received about 5% of the vote. The election comes at a time when many Turks are grappling with rising living costs and residents in the south of Turkey are still reeling from February's tragic earthquakes. We'll go to Istanbul for the latest. In another highly anticipated election in Thailand, voters decisively rejected the ruling military-backed government, which came to power in a 2014 coup, voting in large numbers for the youth-led reformist opposition Move Forward Party and the populist Thu Thai Party, controlled by the billionaire Shinawatra family. The two parties have agreed to form a coalition with other groups, though they'll have to contend with rules established by the military, which gives the junta significant power. This is Move Forward leader Peter Lamjaroenrat.
The sentiment of the era has changed, and it's right. It was the right timing that people have been through enough of lost decade in the past decade, and today is a new day.
Move Forward has vowed to reform Thailand's lèse majesté laws, which saw people arrested and jailed for insulting the monarchy following mass youth-led protests in 2020 calling for reforms to the royal system. Ukraine says at least four people were killed today and a hospital was hit in a Russian missile attack in the Donetsk city of Avdiivka. This comes as Ukraine's military said it's made advances in the devastated eastern city of Bakhmut, pushing back Russian forces, though Russia still retains control over the majority of the area. Earlier today, Russia said two senior military officers were killed in the eastern Donetsk region, which is home to Bakhmut. Over the weekend, the Washington Post reported recently leaked U.S. intelligence shows the head of the Russian mercenary Wagner group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, offered in January to give Ukraine's military the location of Russian troops to attack if it pulled back Ukrainian forces from Bakhmut. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is in the UK, where the British government pledged long-range attack drones for Kyiv's fight against Russia's invasion. The visit comes as part of a whirlwind European tour over the weekend, where Zelensky met with Pope Francis at the Vatican and Italian leaders in Rome, followed by stops in Germany, which pledged nearly $3 billion in new military aid, and France, which promised more armored tanks. The Israeli army and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Gaza agreed to an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire Saturday after 5 days of fighting in which at least 33 Palestinians, including children, were killed. One Israeli was killed. Many Gazans were facing the loss or destruction of their homes after Israel's air raid campaign, as well as the trauma of the attacks. This is a young girl in Gaza.
My childhood feelings and dreams were all in this house. I was brought up in this house. I used to have fun, study, and play here, and all my siblings' toys were in it. We lived the most beautiful days of our lives here, but when they destroyed it, we do not know where to go.
In the occupied West Bank, three Palestinians were reported killed during Israeli raids in or near Nablus in recent days. This all comes as Palestinians mark the 75th anniversary of what they call the Nakba, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, over 700,000, were forcibly expelled from their homes before and during the formation of the State of Israel in 1948. In Burma, at least six people were reported dead after a powerful cyclone made landfall on Sunday. Cyclone Moka is one of the most powerful storms to hit the region. Several hundred Rohingya refugee shelters were torn apart, while the capital of the northwestern Rakhine State was almost completely destroyed. Power and communication lines have been disrupted, with aid workers struggling to reach areas in need. The cyclone also triggered massive floods and landslides in neighboring Bangladesh. In Kenya, the death toll from the starvation cult Good News International Church has risen to 201, many of them children. The apocalyptic cult's leader, Paul McKenzie, is accused of ordering his followers to starve themselves and their children to death. A commission is investigating whether oversight by administrative or intelligence authorities played any role. In Guatemala, the prominent investigative newspaper, El Periódico, is closing after months of intensifying harassment and persecution from the right-wing government of President Alejandro Giammattei. Founder José Rubén Zamora remains in detention after nearly 1 year, accused of money laundering and other charges that human rights and press freedom groups have denounced as political retaliation over exposés of government corruption. Zamora's trial began earlier this month. Meanwhile, several of El Periódico's journalists and columnists are also being investigated by Guatemalan authorities. The newspaper laid off most of its staff and shut down its print edition in November. In immigration news, government officials confirmed Friday a 17-year-old unaccompanied migrant teen died at a U.S. Health and Human Services facility in Florida earlier this month. Angel Eduardo Mardiaga Espinosa, who is from Honduras, was found unconscious and later pronounced dead at a local hospital. The Honduran government is demanding an investigation into his death. Meanwhile, the teen's mother says she's received no information about the cause of death. Espinosa reportedly had epilepsy. CBS News reports this is the second death of an unaccompanied migrant child under the Biden administration. A 4-year-old child from Honduras died in March in HHS custody after being hospitalized for cardiac arrest. That death was not previously reported by government officials. Alabama Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville has come under fire for comments defending white nationalists and the Pentagon's efforts to rid them from its ranks. He made the comments last week while talking to NPR's Alabama-based station WBHM.
You mentioned the Biden administration trying to prevent white nationalists from being in the military. Do you believe they should allow white nationalists in the military?
Well, they call them that. I call them Americans.
Tuberville and his team have since unsuccessfully tried to walk back the comments. Tuberville told NBC's Julie Serkin, quote, "I look at a white nationalist as a Trump Republican," unquote. Tuberville was already under fire for holding up military nominees over a Pentagon policy which covers paid leave for workers who have to travel out of state to get an abortion. Tuberville also said the fact that a jury found Donald Trump liable for the sexual abuse and defamation of E. Jean Carroll, quote, "makes me want to vote for him twice," unquote. In related news, The Washington Post is reporting suspected Pentagon leaker Jack Teixeira was obsessed with guns and was preparing for a race war. Videos and chat logs show the 21-year-old National Guard member viewed Black people, liberals, Jews, and LGBT people as enemies and threats he may have to fight. In Buffalo, New York community members and loved ones gathered Sunday to commemorate the victims of last year's massacre at Topps Supermarket, in which a white supremacist shot dead 10 Black people. Governor Kathy Hochul, Attorney General Letitia James, and Senator Chuck Schumer attended the one-year remembrance. North Carolina's Democratic Governor Roy Cooper vetoed a Republican-led bill banning nearly all abortions after 12 weeks, setting up an likely override vote. Republicans have a supermajority in the North Carolina legislature, but it would only take one defector to keep the veto in place. Governor Cooper signed the veto at an abortion rights rally in Raleigh on Saturday, which 2,000 people attended. This is reproductive rights advocate Janice Robinson speaking.
We do not appreciate what the Republicans have done in trying to take away our rights, passing this monster bill that is going to make it so much harder for women to have access to abortion care. And if the legislatures do not sustain this veto, we will definitely make sure that there are people elected that are about protecting women's rights when it comes to the election in 2024.
In Texas, a woman was shot dead by her boyfriend after she returned from traveling to Colorado to get an abortion, where the procedure remains legal. Abortions are banned in Texas. Police say Harold Thompson, who's been arrested and charged with murdering 26-year-old Gabriela Gonzalez, did not want her to terminate her pregnancy. Florida's education officials blocked dozens of textbooks and forced publishers to edit dozens of others to remove information on racial and social justice issues. This comes as part of Republican Governor Ron DeSantis's ongoing campaign criminalizing the teaching of critical race theory, LGBTQ topics, and other issues he describes as, quote, woke indoctrination. One middle school textbook no longer includes a section on Black Lives Matter and the police murder of George Floyd. Meanwhile, DeSantis has signed into law a bill that will allow health care providers and insurers to deny patient care on the basis of religious or moral beliefs. Human rights advocates say the legislation will lead to more discrimination against LGBTQ people. In San Francisco, the transgendered community and loved ones of slain activist Banco Brown are calling for justice for the late 24-year-old Black trans man. Brown was shot dead outside a Walgreens by a security guard in April after he allegedly tried to steal snacks from the store. The shooter has not been charged. Banco Brown's loved ones say he suffered from food and housing insecurity in a city known for its vast inequalities. And here in New York, Daniel Penny, the ex-Marine who choked beloved street performer Jordan Neely to death while on the subway, was arraigned Friday on a charge of second-degree manslaughter and freed pending trial. Neely's family blasted the charge as overly lenient for the unprovoked killing in which Penny used a technique known to be lethal. Before he was killed, Jordan Neely was crying out he was hungry and thirsty and may have been suffering a mental health crisis. This is Dante Mills, an attorney for the Neely family.
No one on that train asked Jordan, what's wrong? How can I help you? He was choked to death instead. So for everybody saying, I've been on the train and I've been afraid before, and I can't tell you what I would have done in that situation, I'm going to tell you. Ask how you can help. Please. Don't attack. Don't choke. Don't kill. Don't take someone's life. Don't take someone's loved one from them because they're in a bad place.
Jordan Neely's funeral is scheduled for Friday in Harlem. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, Turkey appears to be headed for a presidential runoff that could put an end to Tayyip Erdogan's 20 years in power. Back in a minute.
Pick up your keys at the lost and found.
ecosystem by 47 Seoul. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Turkey's presidential election appears to be headed to a runoff in 2 weeks. Preliminary results show Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan received 49.4% of the vote. His main challenger, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, received just under 45%. The two candidates will likely face each other in a second round of voting on May 28th. Kılıçdaroğlu campaigned on a vow to end what he called Erdogan's authoritarian rule. Erdogan has been in power for 20 years, first as prime minister, then as president. On Sunday, Erdogan spoke to a crowd outside the AK Party headquarters in Ankara.
If the decision of our nation shows that the elections have been completed, then there is no problem. Elections for the lawmakers of the Grand National Assembly of Turkey resulted in Our People's Alliance winning the majority. Currently, the majority in the parliament is in Our People's Alliance. Our alliance dominates almost all commissions. Therefore, we do not doubt that the choice of our nation, which gave the majority in the parliament to our alliance, will be in favor of trust and stability in the presidential election.
Earlier today, Erdogan's challenger, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, said he would prevail in the runoff.
Despite all his smear campaigns and insults, Erdogan did not get the result he expected. Nobody should get excited, but a fait accompli. Elections are not won on the balcony. Election data still continues to come in. If our nation decides on a runoff, with our pleasure, we'll definitely win this election in the second round. Everyone will see it.
For more, we go to Istanbul, Turkey, where we're joined by Kaya Genç, an award-winning Turkish essayist and historian. He's the author of several books, including most recently The Lion and the Nightingale, A Journey Through Modern Turkey. He's covered the Turkish elections for the London Review of Books. His recent article for The Nation is headlined The Political Aftershock of Turkey's Devastating Earthquake. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kaya Genç. Can you start off by talking about the significance of this runoff and that it is likely going to a runoff on May 28th?
This was a total shock because we were expecting a clear opposition victory. All the polls were pointing to that direction. And so we were preparing to write the political obituary of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Turkey's president for 2 decades. But Erdogan made a stunning comeback, and that was a total blow for people in Istanbul. Istanbul voted predominantly for the opposition, but when you look at the whole country, the whole ballots opened. Now it seems like we've been mistaken in the polls, and Erdogan has a 5-point lead, and the third candidate in the presidential race is also a right-wing figure whose supporters are more likely to support Erdogan. So if he gets that 5% as well, it will be an easy, comfortable win for Erdogan for the next elections. But this was a total shock for the Turkish establishment, because for months Erdogan was never speaking optimistically about the election results. He was his usual self, bombastic rhetoric, muscular nationalism, but he never said we are going to win definitely. This is what the opposition said. The opposition was very certain that this was the end of Erdogan, that we were getting rid of him in the first round. And so yesterday there was huge disappointment, and the supporters of the opposition felt a little bit betrayed, because after hours, when the first results came, the opposition leaders were nowhere to be seen. They made very brief appearances during the night, but very brief appearances that gave no hope to the voters whatsoever. So this morning we woke up to a very frustrated city. People feel betrayed and fooled by the pollsters. And I don't know if the opposition will gather enough energy to prepare for the runoff in 2 weeks.
So tell us us about who the opposition leader is, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. Talk about he himself and also the movement that came together to try to defeat Erdogan.
Sure. So Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu is an Alevi, a short, well-mannered, softly spoken Alevi, a grandfatherly figure who is the anti-Erdogan. He speaks in a very civilized way, he never gets angry, he's very calculating, and he seems a very civilized man. So, and he's the leader of the CHP, the Republican People's Party, which is of course the founder of modern Turkey, a century-long party, a century-old party. And so, Kılıçdaroğlu played the role of a mediator, a middleman. And he said, we're going to change the direction of the CHP. We're going to make peace with the religious people. We're going to make peace with the Kurds. We're going to get the support of the nationalists. We are going to be the centerpiece of the anti-Erdogan movement. And that he did very diligently and for months. So he went into meetings, he convinced five other opposition parties to form an alliance, and he called it the National Alliance. And then he also received the support of the Kurds and the far left and the environmentalists. So 13 parties in total supported his bid. So at the one hand, we have these 13 parties and Kılıçdaroğlu as their candidate, always saying the right things, culturally, politically, saying nothing politically incorrect. And then we had Erdogan and his coalition, which was a far-right coalition. And we have to be honest, the winner of yesterday's vote was the far-right in Turkey. And so these are different shades of far-right. One party called Yeniden Refah, which is a very religious party. Another one, a Kurdish religious party. So we thought that Kılıçdaroğlu, a Biden-like figure, white-haired, a bit boring, but a peacemaker, would steal the vote from the extremities of Turkish politics. But we were very badly mistaken. This was a huge win for the extremist movements. And people, when Kılıçdaroğlu, the opposition candidate, announced his bid in March, some people said, this man will never do the job, he will not win, because we need someone as tall and angry and rabble-rousing as Erdogan to beat him. But the opposition party, the CHP, said, no, we'll be very calm, this is the man. And now I think the people who opposed Kılıçdaroğlu's candidacy, maybe in 2 weeks, will say, we were proven right. We need someone a bit more like Erdogan to beat Erdogan. So now the opposition, unfortunately, we'll spend the next few weeks, I think, debating this issue. Did we pick the right candidate? What could we do right? What did we do wrong? Of course, these will help little to win the second round for them. So this will be a frustrating 2 weeks for the opposition. And Erdogan now has the full wind of the Turkish political system in his sails, and he made a speech yesterday. He made it clear that this was a definite win for him, but he fell short of announcing a victory in the first round, so he played his cards right. 3 years ago, in the mayoral elections in Istanbul, the candidate that he picked for Istanbul just rushed to the cameras and said, we won in the first round. And then the opposition candidate, the mayoral candidate for Istanbul, won a few hours later. So Erdogan didn't make this mistake. He didn't rush things. And he seemed confident that he'll win the elections in the second round. So the problem is, Kılıçdaroğlu was 100% confident that he would win in the first round. And how will he be able to explain to his voters that he made a miscalculation and that he can win? Certainly, clearly, definitely in the second round.
Given his authoritarian rule, Erdogan, his enormous power that he's gained over 20 years, do you believe the results of the election? That's number one. And talk about the crisis of the economy in Turkey, not to mention the devastation of the earthquakes in February and that, how that affected people and how people in Turkey are feeling right now.
Yes, so these two questions are actually related. Erdogan has a huge control of the Turkish media. So if you look at CNN's Turkish edition, it's 24 hours Erdogan propaganda. If you look at most mainstream channels, 24-hour Erdogan propaganda. So his authoritarian control over the Turkish media. You look at TRT World, for example. You look at all different channels. It's all about Erdogan's rhetoric. And what is Erdogan's rhetoric so far for the past 2 months? It was this. The opposition parties are organized, curated, if you will, by Joe Biden, by the U.S. imperialist system. So he used this very anti-imperialist rhetoric. And he said any vote for the CHP, the founder of the Turkish Republic, was a vote for Joe Biden. So he used this honestly eccentric rhetoric very carefully. And thanks to his authoritarian control over the media, when opposition candidates were attacked with stones during their campaigning in different Anatolian cities, all these TV channels were saying these are self-organized attacks. The opposition parties stoned themselves. This is a whole drama. These are all scenarios implemented by Biden, by the Pentagon. And when Turkish TV channels interviewed people on the streets, people were saying exactly the same things. So this was an incredible example of how media could form public opinion in Turkey. And as I've been saying, it's more than 85% of Turkish media under Erdogan's control. So they really managed the whole discourse very well. And to the second question, the economic crisis. In February 6th, when the earthquakes killed more than 50,000 people in Syria and Turkey, with a bill of more than $100 billion, Turkey was already in deep trouble. The inflation had soared. The Turkish lira had melted against the dollar for months. And so Turkey was really in a very difficult position. But Erdogan said, using his incredible media dominance, that we are the builders, they are the critics, they are the talkers, we are the builders, and we will use this huge crisis as a great chance to rebuild Turkey. So he started using the rebuild rhetoric, and he said, who has built stuff for you throughout the 20th century? The Turkish right-wing parties did. And who is the representative of the Turkish right-wing legacy now? It's me and my coalition partners. Okay, maybe we are a bit far to the right of the equation, but trust us, we are the builders, we'll rebuild those houses, but we will not do that for free. You will have to pay for us. We'll give you credit, which will help you pay for your new houses. And of course, those houses were destroyed because of irregularities in the whole construction system. And Erdogan took no responsibility whatsoever. He said, those buildings are gone. Drink a glass of cold water and come back to me, vote for me, and let's play this whole game again. And I was listening to